No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us questions at BBSRADIO and the number 1. Maria, you're back.
I am back, Senator. I am back. And actually,
and how are you feeling?
Last Sunday live from the hospital, no less.
Yeah, no, I know. What a trooper.
It has been an incredible journey, and I am doing really, really well. But there were about 3 or 4 days when they always ask you to name and label your pain from 0 to 10. Have you had that, Michael?
Ever? Well, yeah, I've seen that. Yeah. I've never been in that much pain, but yes, I've seen
So I was at an 11 several times, and an 11 is a dark, nasty, horrible place that I wouldn't wish on any living entity.
And so we finally got a hold of that,
and whoa, thank goodness. It was terrible. But so that's all behind me. We've got the pain managed. I'm taking probably a tenth of what I was when I was at that 11. In fact, I just look at the clock just to make sure I keep something in my system for the first week after discharge from the hospital, just so I don't chase the pain. They say you have to stay on top of the pain. But I had my post-op with the surgeon on Friday. He's thrilled with the results. Everybody keeps telling me they cannot believe how well I'm doing and how brave I am to have had a double hip replacement. And I am so looking forward to getting my life back. I cannot tell you. I'm walking without any aid. I'm going up and down 15 stairs where I'm rehabbing now. And it's amazing, just amazing. So thank you for asking.
I don't know if you remember, but before you had the surgery, I told you about my brother who had a similar experience where it was just horrible. I talked to him the day after the surgery or a couple of days after the surgery, and it was just horrible. He was, you know, he was in pain. It was, ooh, ooh, ooh. And then a few weeks later, he went out and bought a Harley.
Because
I feel great. I can move again.
No, I'm 12 days post-surgery today. I'm a new human being. So physical therapy, occupational therapy, the case counselor and the nurses are going to do home visits for the next 2 weeks. And then I guess I get to start living my life because I can't drive yet. And, you know, bend 90 degrees from hips to torso for 3 months. So there's certain precautions that I have to take for a long time. And that's just to help the healing and for it to make sure it sticks and et cetera.
Well, I know the not driving thing because I went through that, and you know, I got to know my Uber people in the neighborhood pretty well, and it's great to hear your voice. Don't change too much because we like the old Maria. So
I do too. I'm just reclaiming her. I lost her. She was just a puddle of a human being, and now the future is bright, my dears.
Good.
But tell me, Michael. I just want our listeners to know that as a shadow senator, not only do you live an amazing existence for the folks in Washington, D.C. and other people in the United States of America that appreciate the drum that you've been banging for however many years been doing so, but this international presence that you have And this conference that you just attended in Edinburgh, Scotland, which is the 13th annual conference of the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, I'd love, and I know our listeners would, to know exactly what was that like? What other kinds of folks did you meet? I know you've gone to similar kinds of things with different names throughout our world. So can you just tell us about that journey?
Yeah, I mean, it was an amazing journey. First of all, I went to Edinburgh, Scotland, where I've never been. And, you know, it's something that I think we don't fully appreciate as Americans when you travel abroad. And I know you travel a lot. But, you know, just the ancient nature. We had a conference that was in the Scottish Parliament and was at Edinburgh University. You know, and you're there at Edinburgh University and they're saying things like, well, this is not the old building. This is only 400 years old. There's the, you know, the old building. That's 900 years old. And you know, the Charles Dickens went to Edinburgh University. So, you know, that first of all, it was just amazing backdrop. And then the people that were there, the conference itself, was amazing. There are 40 members of this organization, and most of them you're probably not familiar with because they have struggles in their own in their own parts of the world. But some of the ones that you probably are familiar with are Tibet. Tibet's a member. Taiwan's a member. The Kurds are a member. The Hmong are a member. Brittany is a member, and there are 40 members, and these are people who are not represented in their own governments around the world. So the District of Columbia was accepted on the basis that we met the international criteria for not being represented, and although our problem is similar, it's really also quite different. These are people, you know, the difference with Washington is that we don't have the same rights that everybody else has, and in that sense, we're oppressed. But these people are economically depressed, most of them, socially oppressed, in ways that we're not in Washington. You know, there's economically, we pay the highest taxes in America, federal taxes, because we make the most money as a community. Mm. So, you know, poverty is, although there are parts of the District of Columbia that are poor, poverty isn't the same for us that it is for many of these people that belong to the organization where poverty is rampant. There's one group, the Baloch, for example, in Balochistan, who are 70 million. Their infant mortality rate is like five times the national average in their country. Their average person doesn't get past the fourth grade in education. Their unemployment rate is, you know, like 10 times the national average. I mean, these and there's 70 million of them. These are people
thinking,
that really suffer.
I thought you were talking fringe societies. The 70 million is formidable. That's a lot
of people. Yeah, it's formidable. And the Hmong are pretty big. There's also a group from India who are members that, you know, are in the millions. And these people are not represented in their own governments. And very often what's happened, it's strange because it's similar to the situation in Washington, in the sense that when the government was set up, you know, they decided to take control of the city. Well, this has happened in other countries, but with the people in Nagaland, for example, which are the part of India I'm talking about, you know, when the British took over the country, they just went, you know, these people, we're just going to set up the government in such a way that these people are cut out. And that's the way it's been for, you know, how long have you know, one was Gandhi's revolution. I mean, this has been
decades.
This way for 50 or 60 years. And some of these people for hundreds of years. Like Brittany is a member, for example, because they're not represented. You know, so it's it was just an amazing organization to be involved with and to interact with these people. We were very, very well received by the membership because, you know, they look at the United States as a beacon of democracy still throughout the world.
Right.
So I think they took great solace in having us as members saying that, you know, maybe this will help us because America is such a great country and they stand so firmly for the ideals of democracy. And so I think that you know, there'll be great expectations of what we can do to help the organization. And it's funny, of course, I came back and I can't get into my government email. I can't get into my government email account because nobody can figure out why. We just last week went through changing our password and everything because it was a problem, and now I can't get in with the new password. So I don't know what kind of emails I'm getting from these people, but I gave out a 100 business cards, so I'm sure I'm hearing we'll get some feedback from them. We'll probably get some of them on the show. The problem is with us is that right now in Edinburgh, for example, it's midnight, but
right.
Some of these people even you know are even further out in terms of the time difference. So we're going to have to work it out, and maybe we'll have to do a podcast or something with them. But I think we'll get some people
on. So tell me, Michael, was this the first time the District of Columbia has attended this particular organization's conference?
Yeah, we were just admitted.
The first time.
We were only admitted last year, so this was
and
the
how
first
often
opportunity.
Do they meet?
Huh? They meet
how
annually in a conference.
Oh, annually.
Yeah, and then this was the 13th conference, and then they have other meetings. They're establishing an office in Washington, so we'll be able to meet probably more regularly than yearly. They have an office. Their main office is in Brussels, and that's where the staff is. And they're now trying to establish an office in Washington. They probably will. So we'll be involved probably more than yearly in terms of meetings.
So where will next year's be? Because I'm sure these take years to plan.
Don't know where next year's is, but I made a suggestion that next year's may be in the United States. But, you know, the problem is that countries don't issue visas to some of these people. For example, in Scotland felt our pain because it's not an unusual situation. It's the same situation they found themselves in. Now there's a Scottish Parliament, but it's not very old. So, you know, they found themselves in the position that many of the members find themselves. So they felt they were very kind and generous. And we met with members of the Scottish Parliament. Our meetings were in Parliament and at the university, and they were very, very good hosts. But there was a group again from Nagaland, they didn't issue visas. None of the delegates from that contingency could come because, you know, part of their grievance is with the UK. Because the UK put them in the position that they're in. You know, their real grievance, I guess, is with the Indian government. But, the people responsible for their situation, I guess, are they see that as when the British ruled. So it's a controversial issue in the UK. So they were denied visas and they weren't allowed to come. And that's the problem with the United States is that they
So tell
feel,
me though, wouldn't it make more sense for them to have it in Brussels where they're headquartered and that's more of a user-friendly destination?
They've had it in Brussels, I think. You know,
I'm sure.
They wanted to before. They've had conferences in Brussels, so they wanted to change it up a little bit. But so I don't
tell me this.
You know,
sorry, I keep interrupting. Since it's a .org, whose agenda is it? Who funds it? Who creates the impetus, the mission statement, all of those things?
Well, there's a group, a governing group, and strangely enough, given the bylaws of the organization, we've been accepted into the governing group. The governing group has to, you have to be nominated and elected. So somebody nominated the District of Columbia, and by virtue of the fact that we're new members and we're nominated, we were accepted. But in a strange twist, we've been accepted with Brittany, which is also a member. So we're kind of co-members of the president, what they call the presidential, I think it's called the presidential something or other, and we're I'm sorry, I'm not better versed, but we're members of the president's council now. So we'll decide where the next meeting is, and funding comes from these various organizations and dues. We pay an annual dues. I think they're, you know, $500 or $1,000. I think we paid $5,000 to get into the organization. That was the initial dues, and that's what supports the organization. So there's dues and other organizations fund the organization, like other nonprofits get funded, you know, grants and other things from member nations and also from the groups themselves. Some of them are pretty poor, and they, you know, they're not currently in good standing because they haven't paid their dues, and so they don't get a vote, and they don't, you know, they can't participate like people that are all paid up. They're, you know, they certainly enforce that because they need the money to survive.
So you have 40 members with probably distinct needs. How do they go about answering that amount of disparate desires? How would that work?
Well, that, you know, that's really the best question because it's very, very difficult. We had a vote to vote for the president's board and to confirm basically the governing, the three governing positions. They have a president and a secretary general and a treasurer that kind of run the organization. And then the president's board is more like the board of directors. And it was so complicated that most of the people couldn't understand it, including myself. I mean, there was, you had to put eight people here, and then you had to vote there, and then you only got one vote for each delegation, but then these people got to vote on special issues. And I mean, it's very, very complicated. And that's a result of the fact that there are so many desperate agendas.
Agendas. I get that your disenfranchisement is what brings you together and unites us.
Yeah.
But surely, and when I did a little research on the entities, not very many of them are well known. Obviously, the District of Columbia would be number one in terms of recognition or notoriety. But even Taiwan and Tibet are on the list. And then these other entities that I've never even seen the word.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Myself included. And, you know, you're over there talking to these people and they're telling you about their terrible problems. And you feel bad because you don't know who they are. You know, you're you know. And then there's other controversial groups like the Afrikaners. Afrikaners are a member.
They fall under?
They're not being treated properly by the South African government.
Well, that I can understand. But what would their entity be? Oh, Afrikaner.
Yeah, Afrikaner.
Okay. Yeah, I see that.
And you know, but you know, as an American who's, you know, who sees the situation in South Africa as such a terrible violation of human rights for so many years, it's really hard to sit there and say, I feel your pain. You know what I mean? To say, look, you oppressed these people for hundreds of years, and now you're complaining because they're in control and they're oppressing you? I mean, yes, I guess you have a grievance, but,
Well, that's where your diplomacy comes into play, right?
The National Council of Slave Owners. You know, it's hard, but on the basis of not being recognized by their own government, they have a grievance. So it's hard to reconcile some of this stuff, although we all come together on that one principle. The problem is trying to reconcile all these things, and there are of course there are problems between the groups themselves. In one instance, for example, we were taking a vote, and two of the Iraqi groups argued for an hour over something because one group felt that it wasn't being properly represented, and the other group felt that they were the proper representatives, and it was really the young versus the old, and again, the old guard versus the new, the new Turks, basically in the fight, and again, it's very hard to sit there. Some young man stands up; he can't be more than 30 years old, and he says, when he starts talking, he says, "Well, last week my best friend was murdered by the government, and I just found out that another friend of mine is in critical condition because he was shot yesterday by the government and, during a protest." It's really hard to hear some of this stuff and then stand up and say, well, we're not represented. You know what I mean? I mean, you feel like, boy, these people have such problems. And it gives you... As we approach the 4th of July, you say to yourself, thank God I grew up in America.
Exactly.
Despite all my problems, not that we don't have problems. But I hope to get some of these people on the show in the future and be a little more, be a little more up to speed on how the organization works.
Well, especially the bigger
members.
Countries.
Huh?
Because Taiwan with a quarter of the other country that you or the country's entities, what are they? They're countries, aren't they?
Yes, Taiwan is. Tibet, of course, is not recognized. But many of these people are minority groups inside other countries.
Within. So the one that you mentioned that's 70 million.
Yeah, that's the Balochistanis, and they're part of. Part of India.
Okay.
And they're
not represented. So, that's a lot, like you said, a lot of people. Is there abject poverty? It sounded like there's illiteracy. It sounds like.
Yeah.
What kind of, is there sexism, racism? I mean, what's the driving force that keeps them down?
Well, I think it's an old, story in politics and war of politics. It's religion, it's ethnicity. I grew up in a family. I grew up in a very strange environment in that my father was probably the most open-minded person I ever met when it came to race and sex and national origin. He pretty much he didn't like a lot of people, but he pretty much believed everybody was the same. Really didn't actually reveled in the kind of cultural differences between people. He used to celebrate, on St. Patrick's Day he was Irish, and on Bastille Day he was French. But then my grandparents, my grandmother, who was an immigrant, she believed every stereotype. Right, the Irish were dumb. The Latina, Hispanics weren't clean. Other Italians. She didn't even like other Italians. She was Northern Italian. The Southern Italians were the mafia.
Yeah.
And that's still going on in the world. You know, that's the main divide. Now, you talk about Tibet or Taiwan and the Chinese, and there really is another, there are other issues there, you know, that those are issues of control and who owns what, and, you know, those issues also play into it geographically and otherwise. But for the most part, I think it's just the same old that you had.
So you have attended more conferences than probably anybody listening to the broadcast. Was it run professionally and economically and with good use of your time? And
We were, you know, I was saying to friends the other day, I just thought Edinburgh was just the most amazing place, but I really didn't get to see it because I landed and was picked up at the airport, checked into my hotel, and immediately taken to the conference where I spent all day till 8 o'clock at night. And then the next morning I was up at 7, and we were from 7 to 8 o'clock at night. And the next day we were up at 7, and we were up 7 till, you know, till the conference ended. So it was 2.5 days, 3 days. And we,
wow.
And every moment was packed with something, and it was really well organized and, you know, well funded, in the sense that most of these conferences are, you know, we weren't hanging out at the Hilton Hotel and having big receptions and stuff. We had,
right.
You know, but they threw a reception for us in Parliament. It was wine and cheese and lots of talk from members of Parliament. And, you know, and they threw another event. Was, we were fed every day. Unfortunately, some of the food was in the form of things like haggis, which is, you know, I didn't have the guts to try. But it was well organized, pretty well funded. Never a moment to spare. Other, you know, it was over at 8 o'clock every night, so you did have an hour or two to go out to a pub and, you know, get ready for the next day. But it was pretty whirlwind.
So that's going to lead us to a segue here. Is what did the folks that you speak to have to say about what's going on in our country with our leader?
Well, you know, they really didn't comment much on it, and I'm not
really
sure. Yeah, I'm not sure if they worried that possibly they would offend us. You know what I mean? They really didn't talk about Donald Trump or the government very much in the United States. They really talked to us about their own problems, and came to us. It was interesting. They came to us as, and they wanted us to understand who they were. You know what I mean? They really didn't say, they really weren't so interested in talking about who we were. They were more interested in talking about who they were, so that we would understand where they were coming from. And, you know, I'm sure that if I had had more time and I had spent more time in pubs, that, you know, people in the pubs would have been more interested. You know what I mean? They would have said.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's true, that's where you get
the unfiltered, the raw, the real, the authentic opinion.
Yeah, and also the news opinion, you know, the opinion that you're getting from, because they're watching it on the news, you know, and it's more of a curiosity. I remember when I first went to, the first time I went to England, a million years ago, the whole Watergate thing was going on. And I remember that when I went into pubs, that's all anybody wanted to talk about. They didn't want to talk about the Queen or what was going on in England, but they were all just fascinated with the whole Watergate thing. So, it was a little surprising they didn't want to talk much about it, but understandable. And you know.
And tell me in terms
of
them getting there.
Because
were you dealing with a lot of fourth world countries?
Yes.
So yes. Them getting to Edinburgh and airplanes and hotel rooms and being picked up and stuff, that must not be a common occurrence for them.
No, and, you know, the options for us were actually when we registered for the conference, we took it upon ourselves. We have an amazing woman named Rima who arranges everything for us on our staff. And we stayed at the Hilton. You know, we stayed at the DoubleTree down in downtown. But options, if you went for the conference options that they gave you, one of the places was a dormitory. So, you know, probably several of them stayed in the dormitory because that was the least expensive way to stay. And then they had old hotels in the city that probably weren't quite, you know, up to the same level that the Hilton was.
Right.
But we arranged our own accommodations. So, yeah, and a lot of them took buses. Whereas we took Uber. That was an interesting thing to me, was that even though the currency was different, and, you know, this is kind of a strange aside, but Scotland prints its own currency, but it really doesn't matter because they use the English pound. And it's the same.
Is that right?
And it's the same as the Scottish pound, but I guess it's a matter of pride that they print the Scottish pound, and it was interesting because when I went to the currency exchange, I had, you know, my assistant had put together some information, and I said I knew there was a Scottish pound, and they just looked at me like I was crazy and like, look, man, they're exactly the same. The Scottish pound and the, you know, it's part of the UK, so a pound is
really?
A pound is a pound is a pound. Yeah, and,
okay.
I was, you know, I was like, well, why did they print it? Well, it's yeah. You know, because they want a picture of a guy in a kilt rather than a picture of a picture of the queen on their money,
exactly.
You know? So that was unusual. And, you know, and I was surprised at everything. And this is how close the world is getting these days, I guess. Everything was, you know, connected electronically. So I walked into a Starbucks. I used my Starbucks card. You know,
oh, really?
An exchange difference. Yeah. You want a Uber? You use your Uber app.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You don't need to set up a special app or anything. You just use the same one you use at home.
I did that last summer in Europe, so I experienced that firsthand. But
yeah,
it's good to know that it's still alive and well, right?
Yeah. And Uber's new in Scotland, and they regulate it differently. They're a big, you have to have a big placard on the side of your car that says not for hire, you know, I forget exactly what it says. You know, they have such a lovely way of saying things like, you know, instead of clean up after your dog, there's signs that say no illegal dog fouling.
No illegal dog what?
Fouling.
F-O-U-L-I-N-G, okay.
Yeah. No illegal dog fouling. Like, you know, it just makes you laugh because you want to think to yourself, well, is there legal dog fouling?
Yeah.
Is there legal and illegal? But anyway, you know, there's a big placard glued to the side of each side of the car that says, this car is not for hire. You know, it has to be hired in advance, so you can't hail it like a cab. And they still have cabs. So it's a relatively new thing there. And the cab drivers, we took both. They don't seem too worried about it. In Washington, D.C., it's, you know, the cab business is dying. It's being totally replaced by Uber. So,
good.
I was amazed that everything worked so well. So
what do you mean?
Closer.
You mean their infrastructure, their
networks?
Yeah,
well, that you didn't have to have a special app to use.
Oh,
your,
I see.
Yeah, or you could just use I use my American Express card everywhere, and there were no fees or anything attached with it. It worked just as well as it worked in the United States. We'll see what my statement looks like. But
so that's what we're becoming pan pandemic, I guess, flat now?
Yes. Yeah. One-worlders. I hate to use that term because it offends so many people. But, yes, we are. The world is getting closer and closer together.
And, of course, we can't let the broadcast go by without your commenting about Trump and tweets.
Well, I do want to do that, but also I want to tell you that I went to another amazing thing yesterday, just briefly.
What?
And I went to the 100th anniversary of the oldest Boy Scout troop in America.
Huh? And, oh, my gosh.
It was actually founded 107 years ago. It was Troop 1. It was founded... It was headquartered next to the White House, and it was established a few days after the charter for the Boy Scouts was established in America. And Troop 1 got to be 250 scouts. So it was too big to be a single troop. So they split it off, and they formed Troop 100 in 1917. The original troop was founded in 1910, but in 1917 they founded Troop 100, and after a few years, Troop 1 died out for some reason. But Troop 100 kept going, and yesterday was their 100th anniversary. So I got to go.
So what was that like? Was it political at all?
No, not at all. I mean,
good.
Not at all. The room was filled with Republicans and Democrats, and Eleanor Holmes Norton and I both gave a speech, but you know, everybody was there for the boys. And this is one thing I want to say, and this is something that bothers me. Now, I have somebody on my staff who generally staffs me at this thing, these sorts of things, but she didn't want to be involved because it was the Boy Scouts, because, you know, they don't have the right political opinion about gay people, and they've been on the wrong side. I agree with her. They've been on the wrong side of the gay issue for a while. Now they're changing. They're changing slowly. But, you know, I really got to tell you that I think it's kind of like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. That Boy Scouts are a good organization. They make better citizens. They make better men. They make better neighbors, and, you know, and we got to get over nitpicking over every little single issue. You know what I mean? Reform the, be involved in the organization and try to reform it. But don't, you know, don't say you're going to boycott it because they don't check all the political boxes on your particular, you know, agenda. I was a Boy Scout. I told the story about how, I was very well received. I told the story about how at summer camp we played a trick on a counselor, and he got even by making us think, me and my best friend, that he had been eaten by a bear. And it went over very well with the Boy Scouts. It's an absolute true story. I think Boy Scouting is an important thing, especially today. We got to, you know, I know you're the mother of several boys, and we
so
can't
the homosexual
let them be raised by the
part
internet.
Of their controversy, is that a part of the past now?
What, the gay thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think it's becoming quickly that I don't think there's a problem with openly gay scouts anymore. I don't know what their position on scoutmasters is. At one time they wouldn't have openly gay scoutmasters. It's not corny, in my opinion, to put your hand over your heart when the flag comes out.
Well, I don't know where sexual orientation has any relevance in any position, frankly.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Really? When is it pertinent?
I'm sorry, when? No, I don't think it's pertinent. But
ever?
No, it never is. And you know, but do we really want to? Do we really want to turn our backs on organizations that are doing positive things in the world if they're not doing everything we want them to do?
No, of course not.
So.
Who amongst us is the one that could throw the first stone?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, really.
And you know what? I have no problem with people standing up in front of the Boy Scout Council and saying it's wrong. You should accept people for what they are. I've got no problem with that. But I also think that, you know, it was a lovely thing to be involved in. This troop has created 130 Eagle Scouts, and that's an amazing number. Anybody that's ever been involved in scouting knows how hard it is to be an Eagle Scout. And as part of my speech, I talked about this guy that I worked for named Charles Manette, who was probably one of the top entertainment lawyers in L.A. He established his own bank, which was one of the largest banks in California. He was chairman of the California Democratic Party. He came in and became chairman of the Democratic National Committee. He helped nominate Walter Mondale, who was an Eagle Scout. He when you walked into his office, there were pictures of him and the Rolling Stones, him and Michael Jackson, him and Frank Sinatra. These are the people he represented. Him and presidents, him and governors. But above his law degree, above all his degrees, behind his desk was his Eagle Scout plaque. That was the top thing on his wall. And you know what? That, you know, it was the first major accomplishment in his life, I believe, in a life full of major accomplishments. So, you know, I think it's a positive thing for boys. My son wasn't interested. I took him to a Cub Scout meeting. He had no interest at all. We didn't push him to do it. I had a daughter that was a Girl Scout. I sold almost as many Girl Scout cookies as I ate. I ate, like, you know, I probably funded the troop with the amount of Thin Mints that I ate in a single year. They're so
for the good of the order,
should probably
right?
be illegal. But, you know, but yeah, let's talk for a minute before we go. The 4th of July is Tuesday. Who's not proud to be an American, right? Who's,
right.
You know, I've never heard anybody say, damn, I wish I was born in a third world country. I'm so sorry I was born in the United States, you know. But what about this tweeting? What about this tweeting? What do you think? Your opinion about it is more important than mine. You're a Republican.
You know what? I think it's reprehensible. I think it's enough. Somebody's got to cut his thumbs off and stop it, or put his hands behind his back or cuff him or something. It's enough already. And the whole Joe Scarborough morning show, he keeps throwing the whatever onto the fire. I mean, it's like, stop. I don't get it, honestly, Michael. And I don't want to do the psychoanalysis of the man and what personality disorder he's suffering from and all of that stuff. It's just, it's undignified, it's unpresidential, it's unnecessary, and it needs to stop now.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. But the thing that I find more troubling, and I get back to this all the time, is that we're so focused on this man, and really what we need to be focused on, I think, are the people that support him, the 45% of America that supports him, and try to figure out how we can heal the wounds that have occurred between the two of us, or bring the divide closer together, or listen to what each side has to say. I you know, that's the thing that I find most troubling, is that instead of eliciting the response that you just gave, we hear a lot of people out there saying, well, you know, he's being picked on, and so he's, you know, like his press secretary said, he hits back. Yes,
right.
But he's the president, you know?
Right.
And people, you know, it seems to me that there's a large contingent in America that's saying, we don't care what this man does. We're just so sick of what's going on that, you know, that we want somebody to throw a hammer into the middle of the works. We want somebody to shake things up and move things in a different direction. But we're not looking for that direction. We're just standing here complaining about them.
Those folks who were disenfranchised and who felt like they weren't a part of the conversation and who voted for him for that reason, now that that's been said and done and you know, we're going, it's more than 6 months now. Let's tap into what is it that we can identify, and how can we solve, and how can you be heard, and how can we put this behind us so we don't have the idiocy day in and day out?
Yes, and you know what? We talk about how he uses this to obscure the issues, but, you know, we're all, it's obscured for all of us. It's not just about him. You know, when we look at the travel ban, that's the perfect example for me. When we look at the travel ban, people are worried about terrorism in the world, and we understand that. But we look at what's going on. You look at the recent shootings, all these terrible things. The kid in Pennsylvania who was killed in road rage. Somebody, the doctor that walked into the hospital and shot people.
Yes.
We're not paying attention to the issues, because it's not about people coming over on planes hurting us. It's about people in this country who are born in this country, who are raised in this country, who are American citizens for the most part, hurting us. So, you know, that's a problem for me, is that it's not just a distraction for the media, and a distraction for Congress, and a distraction for the politicians. It's a distraction for all of us. And until we start listening to each other and trying to figure out what's going on, we're never going to see what's going on.
I couldn't agree with you more, and well said. Because, something's not working, and let's fix it before it goes too long.
Yeah, exactly. And let's come together and let's talk. And it's all about respect, I think, and that we have to sit down and talk. And you know what? When that's why I think our show works for you and me, is I have great respect for you. And that's what I try to, when I think of Republicans and what the differences on the issues are, I try to think of the things that bring us together instead of the things that set us apart. You know what I mean? When I say I have respect for you, I respect the fact that you're a mom, that you work hard, that you're over 21 and you're still trying to get better educated and move on in your, you know, do important things in your life. I respect all these things about you. But I think that when we look at each other, we don't look at those things. You know what I mean? I think that we look at the differences and we focus on the differences instead of looking at the similarities and saying, look, this is a person with a different opinion than I've got, but this is a good person. This is a solid person.
And a different opinion on one or two or three or five things, not on the 100 things.
Right.
Or 500 things that we all have opinions on.
Right.
So, Michael, since this is what you do, which is politics, what could we do? I'm thinking like town hall meetings where there isn't an agenda other than letting the people be heard on both sides.
Yeah, I think we need to do that, and I think we need to reexamine. You know, let me just say, as someone who spent my life in the Democratic Party, I think somebody needs to stand up and say, look, white middle-class working people used to be Democrats. What the hell happened? Find out what happened. Find out why these people don't want to be part of the Democratic Party anymore. You know,
but ironically, though, it didn't happen overnight. This has been fomenting for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that we can go backwards, but I think we could at least start with today. What is it that isn't working for you? What is it that still has you angry? What is it that makes you feel like you're not heard? What is it that makes you think that your vote doesn't count? Even though it does, of course, because you showed us that it did. So to me, just actually having our ears open to hearing what they have to say, as long as they say it respectfully and concisely and without anger, then we can begin the dialogue.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's what we need to do. And I think that will, and I think we need to look at the, and acknowledge our mistakes. There's a lot of things in America that are great, and we all agree on that. Again, on Tuesday, I'm sure that I'm the typical American. I will put my flag out. I will go march in a parade. I will eat a hot dog and a piece of watermelon, you know, and celebrate what is good about America. But we also need to acknowledge some other things, you know, that we encourage all our children to get college educations, but unfortunately, when they get out, they find themselves in debt without a job. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to acknowledge some of those things and try to figure out ways to fix them rather than just to sit around and gripe and say the other side doesn't understand. You know, gun control is a good issue for me. There is a Second Amendment. We need to figure out a way to protect the right of someone to own a firearm, but also protect the public from crazy people that want to walk into nightclubs and shoot 17 people.
Yeah, and hospitals.
And hospitals, right. And the only way we're going to do that is through dialogue. Well, you know, we're out of time.
Again, darn it.
Again. So we'll be back next week, hopefully with a good guest. I'm gonna let us off, you know, we're going to go off the air tonight with a song by Neil Diamond, which I think represents my vision of America. I've taken this liberty of choosing this song. It's called America. And it's so great to have you back, Maria. I'm glad you're on the mend.
Me too. Thank you.
You have the last word. Go ahead.
I just want to thank our listeners, as always, for helping to make us a part of your life, whether you listen live or you download and listen later. We do appreciate the fact that we have a multi-partisan conversation that is respectful, and that's what we want for the rest of our country. So thank you.
Give the people their right to vote.